Okay, so we're recording. Good afternoon. Do you have any questions? I can't see anything. Yes. Yes. Good. Are you enjoying it?
Yes.
Good. Have you started? Start soon. So, in many ways, Gothic is going to dominate the rest of the academic year, if we understand it in its broadest sense of an interest in psychological, the uncanny, the liminal, and defamiliarization. So, what does the uncanny mean? Hello, person online. Something that is astonishing. Okay, can we develop on that? I guess that's unexpected. Good, astonishing, unexpected. Anything else? Unnatural, interesting. Sorry? Okay. Yeah. Anything else? Do you know where we get the word from? Where do we get the word uncanny from? You know? It's the English translation of unheimlich in German from Freud. The most important idea is that it is a disturbance in what is familiar or a familiarity in what is strange and new. So, in the second case, the obvious example is déjà vu. Yeah, when you have déjà vu, there's something which is supposedly new, but it somehow seems familiar. And when things that you know don't seem familiar, that is the other example. So the uncanny can refer to unsettling repetition from déjà vu to coincidences. And of course, coincidences are much more common in literature than they are in real life. Factors that suggest that the universe is not ruled by logic and chance. So that idea that the universe is ruled by logic and chance is very much a neoclassical idea. So we should understand the Gothic in contraposition to the neoclassical. It is also hugely about boundary blurrers. Do you remember what boundary blurrers are? What's a boundary? Okay, so the easiest translation is anomaly. So, another example of the uncanny is animism, in the sense of objects coming to life or acquiring human characteristics. We have all of these wonderful binary categories which have sort of defined our understanding of the world, mainly because we have two hands. An important binary category for us is living and not living, i.e. dead. If there are ambiguous cases between alive and dead, the obvious ones being vampires and zombies, among other things, then they are uncanny. Similarly, another important binary category is between human and non-human. So when animals speak, things like that, it's either Walt Disney or it's uncanny, etc. But that, of course, can work the other way around. So if not in a sort of modern Walking Dead sense, but in a more of a sort of Haiti sense, when you have somebody who is apparently alive, but is in a state of catatonia, then they are, that is also uncanny when somebody seems to be dead. There is a, I think it's called Kopras syndrome. There is a syndrome where people believe that they are dead. And they sort of stop eating things because there's no point because they're dead. It's a slightly bizarre psychological state. But that would be considered uncanny. And of course, if people behave like animals, then that would also be considered uncanny. The uncanny is about the questioning of identity. The reverse of animism is people losing their humanity through madness, trance, or death-like states such as stasis. And stasis will become quite an important concept in the rest of the course. What is stasis? Well, where there's no change. So it's the sort of combination of the moment being frozen and things being eternal. And so, for example, when we talk about Keats's ode on a Grecian urn, there are people who exist in the illustrations. There are low reliefs on pictures. There's a young man and a young woman who are about to kiss and this type of thing. But of course, because it's a picture, they're in a state of stasis. They're never actually going to kiss. There's the promise of something, but that doesn't deliver. And that's pretty uncanny as well. So questioning of identity can also take the form of gender boundary blurring, telepathy, where the individual no longer seems to have complete control over his or her thoughts, or after-death experiences. So, ghosts, of course, are hugely uncanny. Ghosts are probably our ultimate boundary blurrer, because they're dead, but they're not dead. And living dead is probably the most important binary opposites. Finally, the identity is questioned by an encounter with a doppelganger. Hello! What is a doppelganger? Doppelganger. Was ist ein Doppelganger? Yeah. There's been some research about this, and it's relatively common that you will encounter somebody who looks very, very like you, etc. The fact it is a relatively common experience at some point in people's lives, but the idea of encountering yourself, etc. And of course, that's in terms of sort of popular culture, encountering your doppelganger often means you're going to die. All sorts of things mean you get to die, but encountering your doppelganger is one of them. That is another case of the uncanny. Another thing is the inability to express feelings and experience what is beyond language and is therefore unnameable. Okay, so in most everyday life, we can denote things in our native languages. So when you're actually talking about something that cannot be named, that cannot be described, that is quite uncanny because you can conceptualize it in your brain. It's where the conceptualization of your brain diverges from your linguistic ability. And that's quite uncanny because it's not very common that you're actually in that situation where you just, I can't describe what's happening to me. And that is a sort of experience of that sort. Good. So, next one. We'll wait. Well, we won't wait. Okay. Where does the Gothic come from? If you like, or the genre, or anything, just talk to me. Hello, Jorge. Juan Jorge. Jesús de Jorge Juan. Well, sort of, but not totally. So who were the Goths? Sort of German people, sort of, only very sort of. The Goths, probably, I mean, there's more Gothic, probably there's more Gothic genetic material in Northern Italy and the Crimea than there is in Germany these days. But anyway. So the Goths are important in history because they sacked Rome. Okay? And then promptly disappeared from history. But we have the Ostrogoths who ended up in the Crimea and places like that. And we have the Visigoths who ended up in Spain and the Lombards, who I think were also Gothic, I think. Who ended up in Northern Italy. So, whenever we use the word Gothic in cultural studies or in literature, we're using it incredibly loosely. Yeah, it has nothing at all to do with the Goths, the real Goths. And it has very little to do with emo and that type of music and things like that. So, it's a very confusing and not very helpful term. So you said architecture. Why did you say architecture? Okay. So who started you calling cathedrals Gothic? You mean medieval cathedrals and things? Right. Who? Our friend Walpole. So, again, we're in the neoclassical period, we have the situation where architecture is very much done to emulate and imitate the classical architecture. So it's, everything should try and look like Imperial Rome because we're the new Rome, blah, blah, blah. And then Horace Walpole comes along and says, actually, it's much more interesting and much more exciting. The medieval architecture, and it's actually much more English rather than imitating something continental. So he built a house on Strawberry Hill in Twickenham, which still exists if you go to London, on the outskirts of London, and you can visit it, which, I mean, it just looks a little bit like a rather quiche castle of the sort of, yeah, it's not wonderful architecture, but it is the beginning of the revival of what is called neo-Gothic. So there is that idea of architecture, but why do we use the word Gothic to talk about the type of literature we're talking about? Good, okay, so because of the subtitle of The Castle of Otranto. Good. So, does the Gothic start with Horace Walpole in terms of literature? You can have two possibilities, or maybe three. A yes, no, or I don't know. Right, well, as you know, I am very contrary, so the answer is no. It does not come out of the blue with Horace Walpole. We have, for example, a book by Thomas Lodge. Who is Thomas Lodge? You have not read Echis properly. You have an excuse because you haven't got there yet. There is, does it ring a bell or not?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Have you done the first year course? No, you have an excuse as well. You're the only person who can help us, unless Juan Jorge or D. Del Cader can help us. And they don't want to. Okay, shall I tell you? You want to think? Or come on. Okay. Thomas Lodge wrote a novella called Rosalind. And? Yeah. Why is that important? Yeah, good. So Thomas Lodge was the person who wrote the novella about, I think about 8 years before As You Like It, on which As You Like It is based, on Shakespeare's play is based. But he also wrote another novella of about 90 pages called A Marguerite of America. Has nothing to do with America. I don't know why it's called A Marguerite of America, but that's what it's called. Which incorporated elements of revenge tragedy into prose fiction. So there's a lot about that. I mean, so that's where it sort of becomes part of prose, etc. But there's an awful lot of influence of revenge tragedies. And if you think about sort of Macbeth and even King Lear a bit, well, I mean, even sort of Titus Andronicus and things like that a bit. And those sorts of things. Then there's a lot of influence there, you know, with ghosts and witches and things like that. Hamlet as well, you know, there's a ghost. So that is where it starts to be in narrative form rather than dramatic form. And then we have Somlet's Ferdinand Count Fathom, which is this thing up here. You can see it, you can't see it very well. Which was written in 1753, and then Thomas Leyland wrote Longsword, which is this fun thing here, in 1762. So there's a sort of movement towards what Walpole was doing. The idea that there was a beginning to the Gothic should be challenged if we view it in terms of two of its salient features, ghosts and the uncanny. Threatening supernatural beings have existed throughout literary history. Think Beowulf, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, La Morte d'Arthur, the Spanish tragedy, Hamlet, Macbeth, and the Duchess of Malfi. Yeah, so, I mean, this, half of the literature you study in the first year has Gothic elements. So we probably should avoid the idea of it being that. The uncanny, if we understand the uncanny as the gulf between appearance and reality, yeah, things are not what they seem, and an impulse to defamiliarize, we can find the uncanny in Chaucer, in Shakespeare, and in Johnson. Bear in mind that there is uncanniness in coincidence, personification, boundary blurring, and pathetic fallacy, all concepts which we have seen regularly. Literature is fundamentally about vicarious experience. Yeah? When you read something because you want to know what it feels like to be somebody else. That's one of your main reasons for reading something fictional, at least. Nothing is more uncanny than that. Yeah, if uncanniness is about not feeling in your identity, then choosing to adopt or assume the identity of somebody else while you're reading about them, the center of consciousness, is a fundamentally uncanny thing to do. So, more than the Gothic beginning, it would probably be more accurate to say that there was a failed Augustan attempt to expunge the supernatural and the uncanny from literature, which gave rise to a renewed emphasis on these aspects of living through a human brain. If you say everything is basically has some elements of being uncanny or Gothic, until the beginning of the 18th century, yeah, and then people like Pope and Swift come along and try to eliminate everything that is not logical, not reasonable, blah, 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 and they fail because that is part of our human experience. Yeah, we all do occasionally feel fear or overcome by the sublime or blah, 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 blah. So it is a silly idea anyway. Ghosts. What is important about ghosts? What are ghosts? Yes, what in Genesis? The spirits of dead people. In a very literal sense, yes. Can we be less literal? What are ghosts? Right. What's the difference between ghosts and monsters? What's the difference between ghosts and monsters?
As
monsters normally can hurt you. Where do ghosts come from?
When someone dies,
okay, so where do they come from? Yeah, okay, but where do they come from? My last chance, no? Ghosts come from the past. So, ghosts are unspeakable secrets in the past which come and affect the present. What is unfinished or unhealed in the past coming back to haunt the present. E.M. Forster, have you heard of E.M. Forster? Forster. Who wrote A Passage to India and things like that, something you will enjoy next year or whenever you get to the third year. E.M. Forster wrote, once in the world of fiction, what difference is there between an apparition and a mortgage? Do you understand mortgage? Mortgage is hipoteca. So, in the world of fiction, a mortgage is something from the past which is influencing and scaring you in the present, just like a ghost. So, if you think of it in those sort of abstract structural terms, that is what a ghost is. Anything that comes from the past that is likely to unsettle present circumstances. Exactly. Good. So, writers, I mean, this is absolutely standard logical thing for people to be writing about, because writers are haunted by their literary predecessors. Yeah? People have done things before, and you can be accused of copying, or even if you're not accused of copying, you have great writers before you, and they are likely to leave you in the shade, like to make your effort to write a waste of time because they're better than you, etc., etc. There's the influence of the past, which can be uncanny in that sense. Writers are mostly the voices of the dead, and always the voices of the past talking to us in an uncanny way. There is nothing at all natural about reading. Yeah, reading is something that we have been doing for a relatively short period of time in our history. And most of the time when you're reading Thomas Leyland or Tobias Somlett or Thomas Lodge or Shakespeare or Horace Walpole, these people are dead. And it's a bit weird that they are talking to us. Okay, that is uncanny if you think about it. And of course, in anything written, even if it's an email, is past. Yeah, it is a way of conserving the past in an unnatural way. The way that literature emerges from the past, demanding to be reread and reinterpreted repeatedly, parallels the behavior of ghosts. Yeah? So ghosts, you know, when people talk about ghosts, there's the sort of, some crazy lady who appears in a window once a year, what ghosts do. Yeah, they act in a cyclical way, in a repetitive way, and that is not how we normally experience time, and that tends to be what happens with literature. So when you have, and especially with great literature, whenever you actually encounter it, there is an element of deja vu. You are now reading hopefully he is reading, and hopefully you two are soon going to start reading Frankenstein. But you don't read Frankenstein as a completely new thing. You have a previous conception of Frankenstein because you've seen all the horrible American films based on Frankenstein. So that is uncanny, that relationship there of the thing already existing before you know it, as it were. So the way that literature emerges from the past, demanding to be reread and reinterpreted repeatedly, parallels the behavior of ghosts. As Derrida has pointed out, modern times with their films, television, email, answer phones, podcasts, etc., have multiplied, not reduced, our encounters with the past. Yeah, we have situations where people live on, people have email accounts which live on despite the fact that the people have died. You can see whenever anybody famous dies, you'll see all of their films on television, even though they're dead, etc., etc., etc. That's something that we completely accept as normal. It is not normal at all to be re-experiencing somebody in an intense way when they have died. Given how our brains store and edit experience, such voices from the past are inevitably uncanny in that they are familiar but at odds with memory. The ghost is undeniably in the machine. These ghosts therefore challenge our sense of self. So, the sort of current metaphor for the way that memory, human memory works in psychology is something like a Wikipedia page. The Wikipedia page is created and then people add things on top of it. And bizarrely in the human memory, when the things that are added or changed by other people, by external factors, get more hardwired, get better remembered than the original experience. So it's the additions that we remember better. And that's why it's so easy to lead witnesses, if you like. You know, if you say to a witness, doesn't this person look just like the person you saw that night? That's likely actually to make them convince themselves in their mind that there is that relationship. That's why that part of the legal process is so important. You don't lead witnesses, you allow them to express themselves. And of course, when you actually are confronted with the past, for example, something as everyday as looking through a photo album, you are, oh, I don't remember that he knew us then, or was that dog alive when Aunt Bessie was alive? Or, you know, there's all sorts of things that come up in that frozen past which don't coincide with the past of our memories, because we're constantly creating that narrative in our minds. So that experience is uncanny, because generally speaking, we believe photographs, we believe written descriptions of something made at the time, but they don't coincide with what we remember as of the truth. And that, of course, makes us question identity and all of the other things that are related to the uncanny. So, we have said that the Gothic was influenced by a revenge tragedy. That's what we said. That's what I said. What other literary things influenced the Gothic? Online people, help us. What other literary traditions affect and influence the advent of the Gothic? Sorry? Graveyard poetry, 1 point. Good, graveyard poetry. So there's the interest in that graveyard poetry, because we've got the sort of idea of talking to the dead, of being in a lugubrious environment. And of course, in the whole solipsistic thing. Does everybody remember what solipsism is? Solipsism. No? So, solipsism, you said, do you want to say? Well, that's the end product, yes. It's when you question the existence of anything apart from your own thought process. So you're sort of, you know, is the rest of my experience real, or is it just a projection of my imagination? And we had that very much, of course, in the case of Gray's Elegy. If you're in the dark in an unfamiliar place, you begin to question whether you're still alive, even. Folklore, good, which we pronounce folklore. Yes. So British folklore, in terms of popular stories about ghosts and stuff, which is good. Anything else? Medieval? Right. Can we be more specific in terms of literature? Right, okay, so medieval romance. Medieval romance, sort of in general, it can be Arthurian, and of course there are sort of, you know, magic cups and things like that, the Holy Grail and stuff, that appear in the Arthurian side of that, but whatever. I mean, as we said before, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is pretty uncanny. Anything else? Okay, well, we also have ballads. Okay, ballads are often popular stories which may have sort of magical elements, etc., etc. The major works of Spenser and the Elizabethans, not just the revenge tragedies, the sentimental novelists, why? Right, but a little bit. It's even more romantic. It's even more part of the romantic movement. Good, but also, I mean, the main focus in the sentimental novels is feelings. Yeah, and so this is an exploration of the experience of the human mind, which is something which is of no interest at all to the Augustines. So that's different. Is there any foreign influence here? Yes. Probably the biggest immediate influence is the Bang und Strom tradition in German. The sort of Germans get very much into this and have a lot of influence on the two most important Gothic works that we're going to study, which are Frankenstein, and of course even the name Frankenstein is Germanic, and especially on the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. Now, the Rime of the Ancient Mariner is not part of this course, it's part of next course. So, you won't get any sort of questions in this exam that will refer to that. But in one sense that is unfortunate because of course the Rime of the Ancient Mariner was written before Frankenstein. So if there's any influence, it's that way around. But that is just how things are organized. So if that is the case, why is Horace Walpole so important? Yeah, okay. And because of the architecture. Anything else that's important about the Castle of Otranto? Yeah. Right, okay, so the setting is definitely important. It's based on a dream. Okay, and that's very, very sort of a lot of Gothic, because all of these people sort of trained to think very literally, etc., etc. That is actually a place where these things can be inspired, as of course is the case with Frankenstein, yeah, which is based on a dream. So what is the sublime and why was it suddenly so important? What is the sublime? Right. Can we answer that? Well, it refers to a situation which creates terror. Okay, so there is the idea that something is unexpressible, uncontrollable, and basically paralyzes you with fear. So we have as one of the most sublime experiences on offer at this time, what does any young aristocrat or young rich person in Britain do automatically instead of going to university at this time? Exactly, good. And how does the Grand Tour end? What is the traca, the big finale of the Grand Tour? Where do you finish the Grand Tour normally? Very rarely Spain. People could end up in Greece. There is a situation in which when we're at war with France, you have to make plan Bs. So that is when people like Byron go to Spain or go to Greece or go to Albania even. But the normal Grand Tour is you go to a village outside Paris where you're not going to get an embarrassing reputation because you speak French so badly, and you learn enough French to actually be able to survive in Paris. You then go to Paris. You then move south to Italy, probably places like Milan and Venice, almost only Venice, where you will buy a Canaletto or a Tiepolo or something to hang on your bedroom wall or whatever to prove that you've been on the Grand Tour. Canaletto and Tiepolo existed as people creating expensive postcards for British aristocrats so that they could show that they had been on the Grand Tour. Then, of course, you would go to Rome. And after Rome?
Generally speaking, again, until the Romantics, you would have sort of avoided Germany, because Germany wasn't really classical, it wasn't that sort of serious country.
I mean, they might write some good philosophy, but you can just buy the translation of philosophy and actually go there. Continuing in the same direction. You've gone Paris, Venice, Rome. geography is not your strong point. No? You would go to Naples. Why would you go to Naples? Because of the pizzas. Wrong. Not because of the pizzas. Why would you go to Naples? Why might you have a sublime experience in Naples? Why do you have a good chance of having a sublime experience in Naples? What is special about Naples apart from the pizzas and the ice cream? Ice cream is not sublime. Yes, specifically in the second half of the 18th century. The mafia. You could definitely have a sublime experience with the mafia, but no. That is not what people would having a sublime experience. Think of things that might be a sublime experience. What contexts tend to be sublime? What? Tell me something that I can do that will be a sublime experience for me. Are there a lot of sublime experiences in, let's say, London? No. What could I possibly do in London that would be sublime? Yeah, but it's something that makes you awestruck. Not, well, that's a bit scary. But something which leaves you sort of just sort of, is there anything I can do in London which is sublime? Is there anything I can do in Madrid which is sublime? We're using sublime quite technically here. So, I mean, obviously, if you listen to Bach or somebody like that, you may say, oh, this music is sublime. But it isn't really in the technical sense of sublime. So there's no sublime experiences left in the world. How very sad. Right, thank you. Good, excellent. Human activity doesn't tend to create sublime situations. Yeah? It can create nasty situations. It can create maybe scary situations. And you could say, yes, it would be sublime to go into the middle of a Napoleonic battle or something with cannonballs flying around. But we understand what's happening. It doesn't leave you awe-inspired. Nature is a good word to use. What could be happening in terms of nature that would be sublime? A volcano. Do you know the names of any volcanoes? Mount Etna. Thank you. So, is it at Etna or is it Vesuvius? It was in Naples. Is that Edna? I'm getting confused now. Yes, ask Google. I thought it was Vesuvius. I don't know. Yeah, Edna's in Sicily, right, okay. So, Vesuvius, I mean, it could have been Edna, but Vesuvius went into a phase of a lot of activity in the second half of the 18th century. So you had a pretty good chance of ending your grand tour watching a volcano erupting at night. Yeah? So you sort of see, you know, gosh. I mean, you don't get very close, obviously. You want to get back to England eventually. But that is something which is awe-inspiring. I mean, it's the sort of thing which we could all imagine. If I'm not actually in immediate danger, that would be a pretty impressive thing to do on my bucket list. Yeah? Like seeing the Northern Lights. I mean, if you saw the Aurora Borealis, I would imagine that would be pretty sublime. Seeing really, oh shit, I didn't mean to do that. How do I go back? I want to go back. I was trying to turn you off. Ah. Can I just do that? Yes, I think I can do that. Go away and quest that. If mountains which are, just sort of really big, like the Dolomites or something like that, are sublime. These, especially things in nature, which are difficult for us to comprehend. Pretty much anything related to astronomy, once you actually sort of know what you're looking at, is sublime. I mean, when you sort of think about distances and sizes of things in astronomy, it can make you a little bit dizzy, yeah? Because it's just wow. Nature in extremes, such as a non-normal, conventional London weather type experience, is sublime. If you were to go to Antarctica, that would probably be pretty sublime. Or, or Sahara Desert, or Gobi Desert, probably pretty sublime. Quite hot as well. No, you went back to England. You went back and looked after your estate after that. You were cured by that stage. I suppose for some people, sure. I mean, some people might probably popped over to Greece or something. It's pretty close to Corfu, etc. That the sort of standard grand tour was that sort of thing. The thing is that the grand tours lasted from 3 months, would be a pretty quick one, to 8 years. So it depends. It's a very strange phenomenon. It was actually a very good phenomenon for British culture, because these young aristocrats would usually be accompanied by somebody who was of a similar sort of age, who was considered cultured and a good influence. They were called bear keepers. And basically they were somebody who would pay for them to get out of an Italian prison, or to help them be sick when they drunk too much, or whatever. Somebody to get them out of trouble. And then to some extent, I think when, who am I talking about? I think it was Thomas Gray, when Thomas Gray was accompanying Horace Walpole on the grand tour. You could have exciting experiences, because Walpole's dog was, I think it was a spaniel, they were in the lower Swiss Alps and was running along beside the carriage, so the dog got some exercise. And a wolf came out and grabbed the dog, and the dog obviously disappeared and got eaten. It's sort of vaguely exciting. The Grand Tour and Vesuvius going to is the sort of climax of the Grand Tour. Why was I talking about that? Oh yes. So there is that element in terms of people's experiences. This is exciting. What else caused the sublime to be the big word of the next 50 or so years? A very big concept for the Romantic movement as well. Something written. Do you know any English philosophers of the 18th century? Right. There's a guy called Burke. Yeah? Burke wrote Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and the Beautiful in 1757. And basically he distinguished properly, perhaps for the first time, between the two concepts. Terra is the ruling principle of the sublime. Terror is productive of the strongest emotions which the mind is capable of feeling. Indeed, no passion so effectively robs the mind of all its powers of acting and reasoning as fear. So, if you want a sort of visual metaphor, it is situations that leave us like a rabbit or a deer in the headlights of an oncoming car, freezing with panic. However, at a certain distance, the sublime is delightful. Yeah, so if you are underneath the pyroclastic cloud of Vesuvius, it's not fun, probably, because it's about 2,000 degrees. But if you're at a certain distance and you can see the thing and you can imagine the thing, you can visualize the thing, but it's not an immediate danger, then that's quite exciting. Remember that part of the point of literature is the vicarious experience. If you can learn things like what it means to look into the eyes of a tiger without actually having a tiger in front of you, that is useful, but not dangerous. So you can actually improve, and then, you know, the psychology helps that. Those are interesting experiences to have because you are terrified, if you like, but you're not, because you know ultimately it's not real, which is, of course, why some people enjoy horror films, etc. So, the passion caused by the sublime is astonishment. And astonishment hurries us on by an irresistible force. Emptiness, darkness, solitude, and silence provoke fear. However, failing light, confused noises are even more terrible than total darkness and total silence. Now, total silence can be a bit weird, but it's not the same as just hearing a very, very small sound of what is that sound of blah, blah, blah. The same with shadows in the darkness, etc., etc., etc. So all of those things, all of those sensations can be created by writing. More successfully or more clumsily, but that appeals to our sense of the sublime. Is there a male Gothic and a female Gothic? Have any of you read my notes on the Gothic? Not. Yes, you've put it down from there. Okay. And what, according to Anne Radcliffe, was the difference between the two? So, Anne Radcliffe is the origin of Scooby-Doo. Okay? In Scooby-Doo, it's always, and kids, there's always an explanation at the end. In Anne Radcliffe, there's always an explanation at the end. When, I think it's in the Sicilians, when the daughters see a sort of flickering light in the upper rooms of the house, and they think it's a ghost, etc., and it's just their mother isn't really dead, but has been locked up by their father, and blah, 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 blah. There's always an explanation at the end for what seems to be uncanny or supernatural. So, we can call it the explained supernatural. And it focuses on the persecution of the powerless, motherless, young heroine by patriarchal powers, ending in marriage and closure. Okay, so we have a nice sort of conservative ending of the young woman eventually gets married and settled down in a nice place in England where there aren't these nasty elements of tyrannical men. The male Gothic, exemplified by Matthew Lewis, views female sexuality as monstrous and other, and ends with the death of its protagonist. So Radcliffe would call her Gothic terror and Lewis's Gothic horror. Those words have very, very, very little to do with the use of the word terror and horror in modern English usage outside this literary context. So, of course, we talk about horror films, where you would talk about películas de terror. It's just that is her definition of the difference. So, what can be said about the Gothic villain? What do Gothic villains have in common in Scooby-Doo? Not in Scooby-Doo. Okay, so they have some type of extreme desire which is outside reasonableness or control. They are motivated by the satisfaction of that desire without reference to any type of social norm. Anything else? They have scary eyes. Nice slide about that. Scary eyes. There they are. The villain is a murderous tyrant with scary eyes. In almost all cases, what can we say about them in terms of social class? What can we say about them in terms of social class? They are aristocratic. They're aristocrats. Why are they aristocrats? Right, so this is a literature for the bourgeoisie. Yeah, so what can we say about aristocracy? Right. No, I'm more than just perceived. Yes. Do we consider aristocracy a contemporary context? Concept? Sorry. Yeah. What does it mean to be an aristocrat? Why would somebody bother to tell you that they were an aristocrat? Right, they have privilege. That is true. Why do they have privilege? Right, but there's an awful lot of rich people. The richest people in the world are not aristocrats. Right. So they are, the whole thing about being an aristocrat is your lineage. So there are ghosts from the past which influence their present. It is a past concept. It's a concept from the past which probably for a lot of people shouldn't exist anymore, which impinges on the present. Their privileges don't make sense in democratic societies. Yeah. We tend to have a slightly more benign view of monarchy than of aristocracy, and apart from people who read sort of Orlando and Samana and things like that, we don't really put very much importance in aristocracy, I don't think, nowadays. But there is this idea of old, tyrannical values from the past impinging on the present. They are a type of ghost, if we like. Sorry? Well, in some sense, Victor.
Yes, but it's a victim at the same time. Both of them.
but he's more sinner than sinned against, I would say. I mean, it's interesting because there isn't an obvious one in that sort of sense. No. There are more victims than anything. I suppose the villain is scientific ambition. If you like. But it's complicated. But we're going to talk a lot about that, if that, don't worry. What's significant about the name of Count Dracula? He is an aristocrat, right. What type of aristocrat? Correct, right. Where do counts come from? Okay, our word county comes from count. Are there any counts in England? Very good. So, by calling somebody Count Dracula, you're saying they're foreign, they're continental. Yeah, they're not. If it was Earl Dracula, the implication of the name would be completely different. Yeah, but by being Count Dracula, they're foreign. Yeah, they're not sure about this one. So there is that idea of country is also where the aristocracy still has a greater power than the bourgeoisie. That is another reason why a lot of it happens abroad. It's always convenient to have tragic non-functional societies abroad. Think of all of the Shakespeare tragedies, because you're not accusing anybody in power in your own country. But there's also that idea that it's sort of related to weird foreign ideas like Catholicism, things like that, that are threatening if you are English at this time. Oh yes, definitely yes. Things like image worshipping, or what would be perceived as people, venerating pieces of wood and things like that, was very very much seen as a sort of superstition. The fact of, all sorts of things that were got rid of in the Reformation, like incense. It's very theatrical. There are much more exciting robes and exciting props and sort of theatrical props in Catholicism than there are in, and there's more, there is some, liturgy. In Anglicanism, but in terms of raising up the host and the idea of the whole problem with transubstantiation for European Christianity is that in Hebrew this is my body and this is like my body. It's the same expression. Yeah. In Hebrew, you don't distinguish between a metaphor and a simile, basically. And so, in 1260, if I remember correctly, somebody like Urban VI, nobody's going to question me, decided that transubstantiation was a thing, that it actually literally became the body of Christ. So you had the creation of Corpus Christi as a festival. It was ambiguous before that, and then the next day it was dogma de fe, and everybody had to believe that. And there's all sorts of sort of weirdy things that becomes related to magic. So, do you know the painting of the Flagellation by Piero della Francesca? Well, anyway, it's a very famous Renaissance painting. It's very big on perspective and stuff like this. But underneath it, there's a really, really nasty, horrible piece of anti-Semitism, which is that, probably not painted by him, but painted by somebody in his workshop. He would have decided it was there, or the patron would have decided it was there. But it's about, a Jewish man stealing a holy wafer, I think, the ostia, and trying to cook it or something like that. And eventually, basically, he, and of course, the whole of his family, because they're also guilty because, in the last scene are burnt at the stake. Yeah, for sacrilege against, the body of Christ. The fact that the host can become literally the body of Christ, which is ultimately, if you like, takes religion very, very close to a magic trick, very impressive magic trick, but it's still sort of magic, is the sort of thing that makes Protestants very, very nervous. And so there is all of that type of thing is very much at play in those things. I mean, and it's fascinating because actually nowadays, if I ask people who are sort of practicing Catholics here, you know, do you actually believe that this becomes the body of Christ? And they say, no, it's a symbol. So you're a Protestant. It's weird. But I mean, those ideas actually have naturally just sort of subsided along with superstition, etc. So it's strange, how those things change. But that would have been a hugely important differentiation at that point. And yes, definitely, that was the idea. But, and I think probably as a much more rural society, if you were in somewhere like, certainly if you were in somewhere like Spain in the 18th century, with the country to some extent going backwards or very much stagnated, from being the world superpower, there was more superstition in general around to be had. But I mean, even sort of in the 20th century, you would have people sort of, parading the saint around the village to get rain. And if on the third week it didn't rain, they would throw the saint into the river to punish the saint, etc. So there's quite a lot of magical thinking in popular Catholicism. I'm not talking about serious Catholic dogma, but in popular Catholicism, there's quite a lot of, if you think about somewhere like, where is it, Ayamonte or somewhere, where they basically fight to be able to touch or to carry the Virgin, somewhere like that. From outside, that looks really scary. Yeah? It's like, it's a sort of equivalent of seeing, seeing Shiites beating them, whipping themselves till they're bleeding, as a religious act. That's like, if people can do that to themselves, or people can, are literally punching each other to be able to get to hold the float on which the saint is being carried around. That's sort of scary because that's outside the realms of reasonable rationalism and all of the stuff that was being sold by the neoclassical period in England. Of course, I mean, there are similar sorts of things that happen in England, but you could point to those sorts of things and say, oh, look how superstitious Catholicism. In itself, well, I mean, there are uncanny aspects to it. I mean, God, if you have statues of virgins who cry blood, that is seriously uncanny. There's some pretty gory images as well, around. So yeah, sure. Right, so what can we say about the Gothic heroine? What can we say about the Gothic heroine? Okay, so they're inquisitive in the sense of inquisitive.
No, because they are on one side, they are the main character, and one of the other characters wants to make the plot advance, but on the other side, they are the main.
Right, so they tend to be acted upon, vulnerable, pious, virginal, and orphans. So, if you like, it is, there's a similar element to, the sort of Shakespearean heroine in the sense that you're talking about a young woman who is, between the control of the parents, i.e. father, and the husband. And so there is that sort of moment of potential freedom, which is liberating, but also potentially scary and potentially dangerous. So there are all those sorts of things. And here they are focusing on the fact that they tend to swoon a lot. Swoon means faint. Yeah, so there's lots of desmayos. And as we can see in the Mysteries of Udolpha, there are 10 fainting episodes. Happens all the time. What can we say about the Gothic setting? Where does Gothic happen? Okay, so it happens physically in castles. Any other places? Ruins? Right, crypts, things like dungeons, good. Abbeys. Yeah, abbeys don't exist in England. We ruined them. Yeah, we destroyed all of the abbeys, pretty much all of the abbeys, in the Reformation. So abbeys are from the past. You have some ruins of abbeys. I mean, we don't have functioning abbeys. And they are centers of superstition, blah, 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 with all of the anti-Catholic elements there. So, in terms of more specifics, dungeons, underground passages, attics, and crypts. All of those places are claustrophobic, and they represent the hidden recesses of the mind. Yeah? If you think in terms of, probably the PTSD, really. I mean, if somebody has post-traumatic stress syndrome, when they are awake and conscious and functioning, they can sort of apply reason to their experience. The problem is when you go to sleep, you're likely to relive the trauma. And so there are all those scary places in the mind when the mind takes over and the conscious mind goes to sleep, as it were. So a lot of those places are symbolic of what's happening there. In terms of spooky means frightening, scary, ghostly, castles and stately homes. In terms of that slide, which you can look at more calmly on the video, but often in a bad state of repair, they're often ruins in the middle of nowhere. Of course, you're isolated is important. Haunted or cursed, have forbidden wings or secret passages, or of course in the case of Jane Eyre, an attic, and has a reclusive or sinister owner. And you can see there's a huge amount of repetition. The red means yes, so in terms of these sorts of dominant works of literature, of Gothic fantasy, there tends to be a lot of repetition there. This is 7 and 8. They're probably ghosts or monsters, which we've talked about a bit. How is the supernatural reflected in the Gothic? Supernatural reflected in the Gothic. Right, and what do they represent? Okay. Good. Okay, so the rebellion of the imagination against the tyranny of reason. All of these types of ideas are going to be become important in the Romantic period as well. If you think of the painting by Goya, the Monstrous in the Sueño de la Razón, do you know what's it called? You know what I mean, yeah? That's very, very Gothic. And the whole concept there, and that would be a good, I should probably have had that on the slide. that would be a very good illustration of the Gothic. It's when you go to sleep or when you're in that lucid sleep state or that transitional state. Again, that's a boundary blurring experience when you're half asleep, half awake. Of course, then there's things like sleep paralysis, yeah, when you can't move when you're waking up, I think, usually. I don't think I've ever had that. But that is a very, very uncanny type of experience. You've lost control of your body temporarily, etc. When do Gothic stories take place? When, yes. Not necessarily. They sort of can do, but I mean, the point of the Gothic is sort of people like you and me, experiencing things from the past. So they tend to take place in periods of transition. Now, as I have said a number of times in the first year course, I don't know if he's going to remember this, according to Terry Eagleton, who's a Marxist literary critic from England, all periods are considered transitional, and the middle class are always on the rise. In any period, you can apply those two ideas. But they are situations where there is a coexistence of old medieval or whatever tyrannical, out of date ideas in the same context as more modern people. So, if you go to Transylvania and go to, if the people who were in Frankenstein were not sort of modern Englishmen, but were Romanians of the same period, then it wouldn't have the same impact as normal modern people going and experiencing living in the medieval period, if you like. There's an element of that in terms of the peasants, in terms of everything. It's like traveling into the past as a sort of scary idea. So it is the past coming back to invade the present with a vengeance. So I mean, sometimes it's they're sort of literally supposedly in medieval periods, and sometimes they're actually into the more recent periods where these things have been brought forward, but in societies that are less well developed, if you like. Where does the Gothic get the combination of long ago and far away? What literature have we seen which is always set long ago and far away? No? Sorry? Oh, we haven't really seen anything. Medieval romance. Yeah, medieval romance is always like, you know, it's Theseus in ancient Greece in the Knight's Tale, or in the Wife of Bath's Tale, it is when the recently after the Arthurian period, etc. Or in Le Morte d'Arthur, it's directly in the Arthurian period, etc. A lot of them, yes. I mean, probably especially the tragedies. One of the reasons for that is that, of course, if you, after 1603, you can't mention the name of God on the stage. And so it's easy just to say, okay, well, I'll put everything in Rome or Denmark or Scotland, or places which don't have proper religions. So, you know, you can avoid, having that problem. But yes, that's also true. Right. So we have 5 minutes. Oh dear. And so a tendency to place things, in the past. Italy, of course, is the number one country for, revenge tragedies as well. So it's not surprising that there is all of this. All sorts of stuff. The other places which are not England or America are more threatening because they speak from you. Right, so what is pathetic fallacy?
Right, to some extent, yes. Anything you can add to that? Well, it's also about things around us, often the weather, feeling sympathy for us. So it's like you can, it's like you can influence the weather, it's almost like you're doing it consciously. But it's the standard thing of it raining at funerals in Hollywood films, always. The elements, the weather, whatever, is in sympathy with the human state in that moment. So it's always sunny when you're in love. So that is very, very important in this thing. What is the weather like in Gothic fantasy? Yes, bad. Not good weather. We have a lot of wind, a lot of storms, thunder, rain, fog, snow, lightning, mist, and occasionally it's sunny. But especially with things like fog and mist and night time and storms as well, rain even, if there's heavy rain, things that limit vision are likely also to create more possibility for threatening us because you can't see what's coming out yet. In what way is Gothic literature bourgeois and nationalist? I sort of told you some of the answers to this. Well, it's almost always related to foreigners. Especially Catholic for it. So Gothicism was associated especially with the Whigs, who were the dominant party in the 18th century, with the Anglo-Saxon, so there's this idea of sort of Anglo-Saxon is equal to English, is equal to democracy, Shakespeare, revenge tragedy, and Milton are all sort of in the same bundle completely. Arbitrarily. So Gothicism tends to be anti-French, xenophobic, anti-Catholic, and anti-aristocratic. However, at the same time, it was an expression of anxiety about the emerging world of capitalism, alienation, science, and godlessness. Yeah. So there are many fewer certainties in people's lives because of Catholicism, because of the decline of religion, because of science, things like that. So it's an appeal to that uncertainty in that. Where does Gothic get its trope of a lawless society? Lawless society. What type of literature that we have seen requires a lawless society? A situation where the legal system doesn't function properly. It doesn't function very well. But I was looking more for in revenge tragedy. If there's a situation where the law does not apply equally to everybody, then there is the temptation to take the law into your own hands. If the law functions, then, somebody you love is murdered or whatever, you just
go through the legal channels, and there's no revenge tragedy. You're only tempted to go into revenge mode when you cannot trust the legal system. And so, situations where there is no legal redress, the sort of thing you get in continental Europe with aristocrats, and the mentality of these people, all of that is sort of related. Blah, 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 blah. Okay, more or less. And the important thing, I think, here is to just dispel the idea that this was a rather silly distraction from the progress of good literature. The Victorian novel would have been impossible without the Gothic. A lot of Gothic is very crude and silly and just a sort of bit of a waste of time for most of us now. I mean, you have people like Thomas Gray saying that he and his friends were scared to go to bed, feared to go to sleep after reading some of these Gothic novels. You read them now and it's like, sort of, yeah, okay. But we have Netflix and The Walking Dead and all of these types of things. We live in a situation where there's much more sort of gore in a day-to-day existence. But the psychological realism that comes out of this in the maturity of the Victorian novels just wouldn't have happened without the Gothic. So it is important. And, I mean, but there's a lot of Victorian Gothic. I mean, you've got there's quite a lot of Gothic in things like Jane Eyre, definitely, but in Great Expectations. Quite a lot of later Dickens has a lot of Gothic in it. And then, of course, in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Dracula is Victorian and Gothic. So, even more in the sort of, great works of Victorian literature like Jane Eyre or like Great Expectations, there are a lot of Gothic elements. So it's sort of incorporated. Rather than being just the only focus, there are these sort of things, happen in life. You occasionally sort of, miss your last bus and you're walking through some part of somewhere you don't know, or you have to walk in the countryside in complete darkness to get back to somewhere, or blah, blah, blah. But we do have these types of experiences in our daily life. Not very often, but they do exist. The important thing, of course, is to watch Scooby-Doo. So next week we will look at women writers of the 18th century. I think, as I have planned it, I was going to spend 3 tutorials on Frankenstein.